Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Hello, everyone. I'm Gilbert Cruz, editor of the New York Times Book Review, and this is our podcast. And for the next many months, we'll be highlighting great conversations from our decade-plus archive. We're planning a new iteration of this podcast, and as a result, we're going to take a while to figure out what that might sound like. Until then, we hope you enjoy these trips down memory lane. Here in New York City, at the Public, one of the great non-Broadway nonprofit theaters, there's a new production from the experimental company Elevator Repair Service that dramatizes the 1965 debate between James Baldwin and William F. Buckley at the Cambridge Union. In late 2019, former Book Review editor Pamela Paul spoke to Nicholas Bukola about his book The Fire Is Upon Us, which is in part about this famous debate.
Nicholas, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. I'm honored to be here.
All right. This is a change of subject for you. Why this book?
This book emerged through Baldwin. I was invited to write an essay about Baldwin, and I devoted a few months to just reading everything I could get my hands on. And then I dug into the YouTube archives of all these videos of Baldwin, and I found the debate with Buckley, and I became transfixed. It was just such a dramatic moment of these two men who embodied movements in a way, and they, to have them on this international stage clashing, I sort of became mildly obsessed with it. And so I wrote that essay using the debate as a framing device. And as I worked on the essay, I kept thinking, there's a book in here. And then that book kind of grew and grew and grew to a kind of joint intellectual biography. They're born about a year apart from each other. And so I thought I could sort of weave their intellectual biographies against the backdrop of the rise of the civil rights and conservative movements.
I have to say, you know, a word in favor of YouTube, all of these things are on there. And you can go online and just Google Baldwin-Buckley debate, and it comes right up. I just want to play a quick clip from that debate. This is Baldwin.
We have a civil rights bill now. We had an amendment, the 15th Amendment, nearly 100 years ago. I hate to sound again like an Old Testament prophet, but if the amendment was not honored then, I don't have any reason for believing the civil rights bill will be honored now. And after all, one's been there since before, you know, a lot of other people got there. If one has got to prove one's title to the land, isn't 400 years enough? 400 years, at least three wars?
Later on, we'll play another clip from Buckley, but let's start with something you just mentioned, Nicholas, which is that these two men were born only 15 months apart in New York City, could not have had more different circumstances in terms of their births and upbringing. Let's start with James Baldwin.
Baldwin's born in August 1924 in Harlem, and he's the oldest of nine children. And Baldwin describes his childhood as being one that's really marked by domination. His experience is one in which there's all sorts of individual people in his life, police officers, landladies, landlords, that he sort of sees as enforcing kind of boundaries on his growth as a human being. And he sees his parents victimized by racial oppression, by economic anxiety, by a lack of economic opportunity. And so Baldwin describes growing up in Harlem in his autobiographical writings in a really powerful way of really a set of circumstances in which he feels so limited as a human being, and he has to try to figure out a way to find some modicum of power to fight back against this oppression. So Baldwin is somebody who eventually kind of finds his lever, as he calls it, in language and words. He's obsessed with books, you know, from a very young age. He's reading everything he can get his hands on, trying to find ways in which to make sense of his experience through books. And then he begins writing at a very young age and actually devotes himself to writing as often as he can, and he ends up becoming a young minister. His father was a lay Pentecostal preacher in Harlem storefront churches, and so Baldwin becomes a young minister at the age of 14 and is really taken by the power of language to connect him to his congregation. And although he leaves the church by 17, he remains a preacher his entire life, including the night he debates Buckley.
It really is a sermon.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us, what was his formal education like?
So Baldwin was somebody who, you know, he says that he was not the best of students, but that he, you know, because he had a hard time staying interested in a lot of the things he was learning in school. So in a lot of ways, he was an autodidact, but he had the opportunity. He had a couple of really important teachers in his life, and those teachers encouraged him to apply for a program at DeWitt Clinton High School. And he went to DeWitt Clinton, which, of course, is this, you know, storied place that's produced all sorts of important intellectual and political figures. And so that experience was important because Baldwin at DeWitt Clinton was able to work for the high school literary magazine and had some outlets for his creative abilities. But he was somebody who did not have an opportunity to go to college. So in many ways, you know, people are familiar with Baldwin's writings assume that he has some sort of, you know, elite education. But in fact, he didn't. I mean, he was somebody who was largely self-educated and was really just a student, you know, from, you know, a very early age till, you know, the day he died.
All right. That's a good moment to just pivot quickly to Buckley, because we associate him so much with the institution that he attended, of course, God and Man at Yale. But let's start with his birth in New York City.
Buckley is, you know, as I say at the beginning of the book, he may as well have been born on a different planet, you know, the same city, but may as well have been a different planet. Buckley is somebody who is born into immense wealth. So Buckley's father is somebody who made and lost and regained fortunes in the real estate and oil businesses. His mother comes from old money, a proud daughter of the Confederacy. So I say that, you know, his father had new money, his mother had old money. The key word there is money. And they used that money to provide their 10 children with a very rich upbringing in a lot of ways, and especially educationally.
10 children?
Yeah, there were 10. There were 10.
So they both came from very large families.
They did, indeed.
Interesting.
It's one thing they have in common. The Buckleys had an estate in Sharon, Connecticut, known as Great Elm, 47-acre estate, and they had an elaborate homeschooling for their children. So every subject under the sun, they had live-in tutors that were there full-time. They brought in part-time tutors to cover every other subject. So the Buckleys were really devoted to education, and they were especially devoted to teaching their children a particular worldview. And so the Buckleys were taught a kind of, they called it individualism, but it was really a kind of elitism. They were taught to be very suspicious of any form of collectivism, socialism, communism, and the New Deal policies of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. But they were also taught to be very suspicious of democracy. They were taught that some people are fit to rule, others are fit to be ruled, and they were among those who were fit to rule, of course. And so Buckley really, he never really desires to become his father. He doesn't want to follow him into business, but he really wants to devote his life to defending the worldview that his father taught him and his mother taught him. And so in that hierarchical household where they're taught these values of hierarchy, those values were thoroughly racialized, is one of the key themes of the book. And so Buckley's racial politics in many ways, you know, emerge at a very young age, and he's sustains those throughout his life.
So it's interesting that both Buckley and Baldwin, for very different reasons, are suspicious of certain aspects of American democracy.
That's true. That's true. And these moments, you know, in the book when I say there's a kind of surprising overlaps where, you know, Baldwin and Buckley have the suspicion of liberalism. They have some suspicion of democracy. They have some suspicion of the capacity of law to bring about social change. But, you know, those moments where there's overlaps, there's, of course, very different reasons why they take those positions. And so I think, but in that overlap, we can learn something about our politics, and also in the reasoning that they, you know, both of them use to arrive at those conclusions can really help us make sense of our political moment.
I mean, is it in those moments of odd alignment that the tension is greatest in terms of their differences?
I think that's true. I mean, I think maybe not, you know, there's definitely a lot of tensions, you know, just running through this story. But I think that those moments are, you know, really fascinating. I mean, one example is that Baldwin and Buckley are both great critics of Northern hypocrisy on race. You mm-hmm. know, they will often say, you know, that the one line that's used is the Jim Crowism of the North is just simply more sophisticated. Baldwin would say that sort of thing, and Buckley would say that sort of thing. Of course, Buckley's point was he would say that to get Northerners to lay off of the South, and Baldwin would say that to get all of us to lay into the North, right? And so those moments, I think, are especially powerful to think about. Okay, why is it that Baldwin is looking at somebody, you know, particular politician that he really does not trust. And Buckley's looking at that same politician and does not trust that person. They have these radically different reasons for that distrust. And I think that's really informative for us.
All right, let's jump from their childhood circumstances right to 1965, the year in which this debate, the subject of your book, The Fire Is Upon Us, takes place. Where is James Baldwin at this point in his life and career, 1965?
Baldwin's really at the height of his fame. So Baldwin had published his first novel in 1953, and he'd published by then three novels, Go Tell on the Mountain, Giovanni's Room, and Another Country. So he established himself as a fiction writer, but he'd also then published several essay collections. And in 1963, The Fire Next Time is published. And that's really a book that, I mean, Baldwin's star was already ascending, but that book sort of sent Baldwin to the height of literary fame. I mean, so he's among the most famous writers in the world at that time. And Baldwin's connection to the civil rights movement was always a complicated one. I mean, he describes himself as a witness. I mean, his first interactions with the Jim Crow South are as a journalist. You know, he goes down to the South to cover what's happening, the Black liberation struggle for particular magazines and publications. And so Baldwin says, my job is to write it all down. But he, of course, feels, you know, this sense of obligation to go beyond writing it all down. Of course, his journalism always has a kind of normative dimension to it. But he says, you know, he spends a lot of his life as what he calls a transatlantic commuter, living in Europe and living in the U.S. But he feels a sense of obligation to engage in the struggle. And so by 63, he's kind of identified as a kind of spokesman. He didn't like that label at all. He didn't like most labels. But he really wants to, he's engaged in this, that both through his fiction and nonfiction writing, what he's really trying to do is provide his readers with a sense of what the world looks like through the eyes of a variety of people in the South and also elsewhere in the country who are in the midst of this struggle to change the country. So that's really what Baldwin is up to. So at that moment in 65 at Cambridge, Baldwin is internationally famous. So those students that are packed into that Union debating hall, they're there really there to see Baldwin because Buckley hadn't quite achieved international fame yet.
All right, let's talk about William F. Buckley. Where is he in 1965 in terms of his career?
So Buckley, by 65, is second only to Barry Goldwater in terms of a sort of face of the American conservative movement. And Buckley had played really this outsized role in shaping what we now call the conservative movement. So Buckley, in 1955, starts National Review magazine, which the idea of the magazine was to try to do what progressive magazines had done in their first half of the 20th century. Magazines like The Nation and The New Republic had done so much to sort of shape the American left. And so Buckley has this idea that there's not really anything that we could call a conservative movement, a coherent conservative movement in 55. So he has this idea to use a magazine to bring folks together, coalition together. And so he founds National Review, and right at the same moment he's founding National Review, the civil rights movement, the latest phase in the civil rights struggle is occurring. The lynching of Emmett Till, the reaction to that, the arrest of Rosa Parks, the Montgomery bus boycott. So Buckley is very consciously trying to shape a conservative movement, and he has to make a lot of decisions about how the conservative movement should react to the Black liberation struggle.
How influential is the National Review in 1965? What's the circulation like, and who's reading it?
The National Review is a really powerful magazine by 65. I mean, it's a magazine like a lot of magazines that struggles over the years, you know, in that first decade. But really the role that National Review plays, I think, is you know, Buckley kind of establishes himself as a sort of gatekeeper for the movement. He's trying to sort of, as one of my colleagues puts it, edit conservatism, figure out who should be part of the coalition and who should be left out. And so he, you know, writes certain folks out of the movement, like Ayn Rand and eventually, you know, Robert Welch and the John Birch Society. So Buckley is really playing this role. People know that the magazine has a sort of outsized role in kind of shaping the movement and figuring out who's allowed to participate and who's not. And so the influence of National Review is, I think, you know, by 65, there's no question it is the most recognized conservative organ in the country. And definitely, although Buckley did not get to play the role that he hoped to play in the Goldwater campaign, he hoped to be a kind of liaison between the conservative intellectual community and the campaign. But he still is playing a kind of informal role as a sort of somebody who's promoted. He's a promoter of ideas. He's a popularizer of conservative ideas. As one of his biographers calls him, the St. Paul of the conservative movement. He's really an evangelist for ideas. He's not an originator of ideas, but he's very good at spreading the ideas.
Right. He's not even an originator in this particular debate, but we'll get to that. Let's just hear quickly a clip of Buckley from this debate.
The trouble in America where the Negro community is concerned is a very complicated one. I urge those of you who have an actual rather than a purely ideologized interest in the problem To read the book Beyond the Melting Pot by Professor Glaser, also co-author of The Lonely Crowd, a prominent Jewish intellectual, who points to the fact that the situation in America where the Negroes are concerned is extremely complex as a result of an unfortunate conjunction of two factors. One is the dreadful efforts to perpetuate discrimination by many individual American citizens as a result of their lack of that final and ultimate concern which some people are truly trying to agitate. The other is as a result of the failure of the Negro community itself to make certain exertions which were made by other minority groups during the American experience.
Interesting you mentioned Barry Goldwater earlier, because Barry Goldwater, Strom Thurmond, both of them were original choices to be the person to debate Baldwin. What happened with them, and how did it end up being William F. Buckley?
That was one of the first puzzles to solve, was how did this happen in the first place? And there really wasn't any detailed account that I was able to find in the existing literature of, like, how did these two guys end up there that night? So really, and it kind of happened by accident in a lot of ways. The union was contacted by Baldwin's publicist.
So this is Cambridge Union, the students' union at Cambridge University in England.
Right. So Cambridge Union, the oldest debating society in the world, they had just marked their 150th anniversary just weeks prior to the Buckley-Baldwin debate. The union is contacted by a publicist for Corgi Books, who is promoting the paperback release of Baldwin's third novel.
So it's a book tour.
It's a book tour, exactly.
All right.
Exactly. And so the president of the union was an undergraduate student named Peter Fullerton, says, well, I can't host a book event. This is a debating society. So what I can do is host a debate related to the themes of Mr. Baldwin's writings. And so they agree to that. And it's sort of an interesting, the sort of backstory that I was able to uncover in the Baldwin archives at the Schomburg in Harlem. What was really interesting, the kind of back and forth between the agents and the publicists and so on. They sort of agreed in principle to have Baldwin come. And then the first idea that Fullerton had was to say, you know, I'll invite somebody like Strom Thurmond, somebody who's a devoted segregationist, to debate Baldwin. And Fullerton doesn't remember exactly what the response was, but he knows it was negative, and invited Barry Goldwater, who had, of course, voted against the Civil Rights Act and was a different kind of skeptic of the Civil Rights Revolution. And so at some point, there was another student at Cambridge named Michael Tugendhat, who had met Buckley in 1963 and knew enough about him to know that he was sort of the perfect person for this role. He was a skilled debater. He was a critic of the civil rights movement. So they contacted Buckley, who was on his annual ski vacation in Switzerland, and asked him if he would come debate. And he was not one to turn down any opportunity to debate. And he had established in print that he thought Baldwin was, as he called him, an eloquent menace. And he was eager to take him on at Cambridge.
How did Baldwin feel about Buckley and going up against him?
So there isn't as much evidence of Baldwin's kind of reflections on Buckley prior to the debate that I was able to discover. There's no question that, you know, Buckley was on Baldwin's radar. And Buckley was a sort of figure that Baldwin was eager to challenge. And one of the things I talk about in the book is, in 1962, Baldwin was invited onto the Open Mind television program to debate James Jackson Kilpatrick, who was one of the country's leading salesmen for segregation, a very close friend and colleague of Buckley, who was sort of one of Buckley's go-to guys on race. And it was the kind of thing where a lot of Baldwin's friends and handlers didn't want him to do it, right? You should not sit across a table from a segregationist. You're going to dignify his views by your presence. But Baldwin really felt an obligation to engage with people like Kilpatrick. And he actually thought that people like Kilpatrick and Buckley, they had a great deal of responsibility to bear in the racial violence, the racial nightmare.
Is that something that people can watch on YouTube as well, or somewhere online? Is that still out there?
You know, it's a strange thing. The Open Mind has an incredible archive. You can actually watch shows going back to the 50s, but they don't seem to have this one. And so I hope there is a recording of it. So what's interesting is that at the Schomburg, Baldwin kept a complete transcript of that encounter. It's another thing that hadn't really been written about very much. And it's just this, I mean, it's an amazing, just reading it is so powerful, because it's right after the Battle at Ole Miss, right after James Meredith is attempting to register for classes at the University of Mississippi and all hell breaks loose. You know, there's violence. And Baldwin begins the show. They're welcome to the show. And Baldwin looks at Kilpatrick and says, "You think there's a difference between men like you who write these sophisticated books and articles defending segregation and the people in those streets committing acts of violence?" And he says, "I hold you, sir, far more responsible than those people in those streets, because they are caught in a web of delusion, this delusion of white supremacy, and you are weaving that web for purposes that have nothing to do with them. And he says, I accuse you of betraying those white people in the South. You are pursuing your own agenda for your own purposes. And so Baldwin starts out the conversation that way, and then proceeds to kind of play the role of kind of cross-examining Kilpatrick for the duration of the show, and just kind of interrogating him about his white supremacist views. It's an extraordinarily powerful encounter. Yeah, so hopefully, I'm hoping with the book coming out, maybe some of these things will be uncovered in some archive. Somebody has a recording, an audio or video recording of that.
All right, until then, let's talk about this night. It's February 18th, 1965. Set the stage for us. Who is there? How is it structured? Who could see it? How public was this?
So the debate, although it came together very last minute, so the sort of wheels began turning on putting this night together in January 65, and the actual night of the debate is February 18th, 1965. And so you have packed, the union debating hall was filled. I mean, if you watch the video, you can see there's people not only sitting in every spot on the benches and in the galleries, but they're also sitting on the floor. I mean, Buckley and Baldwin have to like walk over students as they're going. So you have mostly students. You also have guests to the union. So the students were, so many of the students that were there are sort of what they call members of the union who had a voting. They're, able to vote and ask questions during the debates. But the way this debate was structured was there were two student debaters, one on each side. So the motion before the House was the American dream is at the expense of the American Negro. And so there's two student debaters. One gives a speech on each side of that motion. And then Baldwin gets up to speak, and he speaks for about 24 minutes. And then Buckley gets up to speak, and he speaks for about 29 minutes. And there's no exchange between the two of them, which is one of the things that is, in some ways unfortunate about the way it was structured.
Yes.
And that may have been due to some of the backroom negotiations about what they were willing, what Baldwin's people especially were willing to allow to happen that night. But there is one thing that's left out of the BBC recording that was really fascinating to discover.
It's edited, right? The one that you can see online.
Right. So the one you can see online, the student speeches are edited down, and then Buckley's speech is edited by about a third. And one of the things that's edited out of the Buckley speech, the questions that the students asked him. So at the union, like in the House of Commons, students could stand up and the speaker they could call on the student to, for a point of information or for a question. And so there's only one of those, what they called interruptions in the speech that you see on YouTube. And there's actually about four or five more that are really interesting. I mean, both for the questions that are asked are really good questions, but also Buckley is a master at responding to those questions in a kind of clever way that almost always elicits laughter, and he's able to kind of diffuse the situation. But yeah, so the Cambridge Union itself kept audio recordings of these debates, but they did not have the audio recording of this particular debate. They thought it was lost or destroyed. So I was able to find one of the students from that era who had an old reel-to-reel copy of the full Buckley and Baldwin speeches, and he sent it to me from England, and I got it digitized, and so that's available for folks on the audiobook and the full transcripts and as an appendix to the book itself.
One of the interesting things about Buckley's speech is that he based it on a piece that was written by Gary Wills in the National Review. So this wasn't, something he came up with organically. I think that might surprise people who are more familiar with Wills's later work, but most people know that he was early on protege of Buckley at the National Review. What was this piece? What did it say? Why did Buckley choose to base his talk on that?
Buckley says that Wills is one of the National Review's great discoveries. Wills sends him, a sample of his writing when he's very young, and Buckley sees, that Wills has an incredible talent and brings him on to sort of do a lot of like reviews for National Review, and then also to begin writing some essays about religion. And so when The Fire Next Time, of course, emerges initially, the bulk of it emerges in November 1962 as a long piece for The New Yorker magazine called Letter from a Region of My Mind. And when that piece comes out in late 62, the reaction is, it's a literary sensation. People are, all sorts of literary folks are responding to it. When the book itself, The Fire Next Time, which collects that piece together with a short piece Baldwin wrote for the Progressive magazine in late 62, that book, is just this immediate bestseller, and everyone, there's very few critics have a crossword to say about it. So Buckley sees an opportunity for National Review. He's already identified Baldwin as this dangerous, threat. And so he says, what I need to do is get somebody to write a sophisticated critique of Baldwin for the magazine. And he identifies Wills as the right person to do that. Wills is somebody who's, Baldwin in The Fire Next Time, and that book is dealing with such huge issues, philosophical issues, religious issues. And Buckley recognizes that Wills is the writer in his orbit who has the kind of skills to take Baldwin on. So, Wills, sets down and reads every bit of Baldwin he can get his hands on, and he writes this piece, What Color is God? And the piece itself is much more sophisticated than what Buckley produces at Cambridge. Mm-hmm. But it is, ways in which Buckley was faithful to the Wills piece. Wills read Baldwin as somebody who is calling for an overthrow of Western civilization. And Wills says things like, Baldwin wants us to, raid the libraries and burn Plato and Aristotle and the Bibles and so on. And that, to me, is a really flawed reading of what Baldwin's up to in that text and in the rest of his writing. But Buckley takes that and runs with it. It's one of the great mysteries of the book is whether or not Buckley really ever read Baldwin. Mm-hmm. I don't really know. I think he may have just read other people reading Baldwin and then taken what he liked and run with it.
All right, let's just put in another clip here of Baldwin from the debate before we talk about it.
Let me put it this way. That from a very literal point of view, the harbors and the ports and the railroads of the country, the economy, especially of the southern states, could not conceivably be what it has become if they had not had, and do not still have indeed, and for so long, so many generations, cheap labor. I am stating very seriously, and this is not an overstatement, and I picked the cotton, and I carried it to market, and I built the railroad under someone else's whip for nothing. For nothing.
So Baldwin does something very different with his portion of this debate. How would you characterize the talk that he gives?
Although the Union had existed for 150 years prior to this night, I'm pretty sure that there was never a speech quite like the speech that Baldwin delivered that night, because he, a lot of, formal debate is this kind of combination of intellectual exercise and performance art, a lot of humor injected and that sort of thing. But Baldwin arrives that night and he delivers a sermon. He delivers a Jeremiad, right? He is there to say things that people don't want to hear.
Yes.
The Jeremiad about white supremacy, really. And so Baldwin's speech, I think there's like three really, really important things to keep in mind with Baldwin's speech. One is that he wants to talk about the ways in which the doctrine of white supremacy, the impact it has on what he calls the subjugated. So he talks about the millions of details of every day that communicate to people of color that their lives do not matter. And so Baldwin devotes a great deal of his speech to that, but he also wants to talk about the ways in which white supremacy undermines what he calls the moral lives of its would-be beneficiaries. So the example he gives is among the most powerful you can imagine. At that very moment, the same night of the debate, we're in the thick of the Selma campaign. And so Sheriff Jim Clark, Selma, Alabama, is being, you're seeing me on TV everywhere, you're seeing him in newspapers, brandishing his cattle prod and using it against men, women, and children in the streets of Alabama. And Baldwin says, when Jim Clark uses that cattle prod, what's happening to his victims is ghastly, but in some ways, what's happening inside of him is much, much worse. And what Baldwin is saying there is that Jim Clark is somebody who is caught up in this delusion of white supremacy, and all of his sense of value, his sense of meaning in the world is just caught up in this myth that his whiteness is what gives him value. And so Baldwin says, that's pathetic. This person's life is pathetic. This is what he's clinging to for his sense of meaning. Baldwin objected to thinking about this in terms of like a black liberation, right? He might object to my using that term because this is a liberation struggle that's about all of us, right? Somebody like Jim Clark needs to be liberated from this delusion. And so Baldwin, those are two major pieces, and the other major piece is expense. There's a very powerful, the very powerful language he uses when he says, I picked the cotton, I built the railroads.
Yes.
And so that is a huge theme of his speech, and just trying to draw our attention to the ways in which, that our history of racial injustice is not, history is present in everything we do, Baldwin says, right? So the legacy where past meets present is something he really wants to draw his, all those students and the international audience. He wants people to reflect on legacy and think about the ways in which our history of racial injustice is present in everything we do.
All right, there's so much in there. And I'm going to do something terrible, which is I'm going to jump right to the end, at least of the debate. Who won?
Baldwin won. So Baldwin's side wins. The vote is 544 in favor of Baldwin's side, 144 against. So Baldwin is victorious that night in terms of the vote.
All right, a victory in that debate and in many other ways, but also obviously a subject that continues to resonate. It's amazing how contemporary so much of what they talk about in that debate still is. Nicholas, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Pamela. It's been a pleasure.
This podcast is supported by the Shalom Hartman Institute. For decades, the Shalom Hartman Institute has been the preeminent destination for Jewish ideas and learning. The weekly Identity Crisis podcast with host Yehuda Kurtzer creates better conversations around issues facing contemporary Jewish life. For Heaven's Sake, the award-winning number one Judaism podcast with Daniil Hartman and Yossi Klein Halevi features thoughtful discussions on political and social trends in Israel and Israel-diaspora relations. Discover these chart-topping podcasts at shalomhartman.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
In May 2020, Pamela interviewed Lydia Millett upon the publication of her novel, A Children's Bible, which we later noted as one of the 10 best books of that year. Millett's 12th novel, Dinosaurs, is out this month, and you can find a good long profile of her this weekend in the New York Times Magazine.
Lydia Millett joins us now from outside Tucson, Arizona. Lydia, thanks for being here again.
I'm happy to be here.
How is your quarantine going?
Well, you know, I am not sick. No one in the family is sick, and we're not hungry, and we haven't lost our jobs yet. So I'd say it's going all right.
Are you reading? Because I feel like some people are saying they're having trouble reading and other people are doing nothing but reading.
You know, I've been reading, but it's been mostly nonfiction research for the book that I'm writing now and just the stuff I read for work. So I haven't been reading a lot of fiction in the past couple months.
You're already working on your next novel.
Actually, what I'm writing now is nonfiction. It's a sort of, it's called a bestiary, but it's a kind of combination of, I guess, what you call memoir and thoughts about animals and religion and intertwined forces in culture that relate to extinction and our love of the wild.
Several of those themes are ones that you cover in a children's book. I'm probably most notably environment and kind of end times and also religion. Tell us a little bit about the story you are telling in A Children's Bible.
So this is a tale of a group of children, and mostly teenagers, who are being forced by their parents to spend their summer vacation together in a rented, robber baron kind of mansion in the country, and who strongly resent and dislike their parents. And in the midst of this, a storm comes, a kind of epic storm, and with it, a great flood and chaos descends on the house that they're living in, and the children sort of rebel against their parents.
Okay, so if you weren't clued in by the Great Flood, you might be clued in by the name of the narrator, Evie, or Eve, I think is about 15, that you are doing something allegorical here with the Bible of the title. What function does the Bible have in this story?
The stories that used to be often made into Bible stories for children, the parts of the Bible that were translated in especially the 40s, 50s, and 60s for children to read are selected parts of the Bible. For example, the book of Revelation, the revelation to John is typically left out of children's Bibles. It's not left out of my children's Bible, but it was deemed too harsh and dark and bloody, I think, for children to read. And so in children's Bible stories that used to proliferate, aren't as common now, often illustrated, you would have, you know, the Noah's Ark story and various more child-friendly pieces of the Old Testament and the New. And so I've used to structure the plot kind of some of the events from those Bible stories. And then also there's a little boy in the book, the baby brother of Evie, who narrates it, who's given a children's Bible. They come from a secular family in New York, and he's given a Bible by one of the mothers that they're sequestered with in this big summer house. And so he starts to read it, and he doesn't really understand it. His favorite books are Frog and Toad and George and Martha.
As they should be.
So he sort of interprets it in his own little boy, little secular boy way. And so there's a sort of also a parallel there. So it's his Bible, the children's Bible, and it's also sort of the framework for the plot of the novel.
It's interesting when you talk about child-friendly as defining what ends up in a children's Bible, because the stories, of course, are still fairly terrifying.
They are.
I remember getting up to Cain and Abel in my own children's Bible and then being like, all right, I think I'm done here with this here book of tales.
There's a lot of brutality. But there's not the sort of prophetic, apocalyptic gore of the book of Revelation. But yeah, of course, even the, you know, the Noah's Ark story is extraordinary and apocalyptic in its own way. Of course, it sort of has a happy ending, if you want to read it that way, where animals get saved and the good people get to live on after the flood.
Talk a little bit about the children of the title, because as you said, they're not quite children. I mean, they're mostly teenagers, and they seem very sophisticated.
Right. So, you know, I'm never too interested in developmental verisimilitude with characters. Like, they are sort of hybrid child adults, as teenagers really are, but the kids in this book, they do use a lot of swears. You know, they're quite harsh in their language and judgmental, but at the same time, they're preternaturally articulate to a certain degree. And I think because in a sense I wanted to respect their voices, I wanted to make them authoritative and sort of straight guys in the book against the chaotic collective of the parents who are objectified generally for, I hope, humorous effect, but they're sort of unable to manage their families and their lives. And the teenagers and a couple of young children who make up the sort of band of roving humans at the center of the story, they are mature in, you know, in certain ways. Essentially, this is a book envisioned for adults to read, and so I don't feel like I need to sort of talk down to either children and teenagers or to those who are reading the book by infantilizing these. Because, you know, we all know how resilient teenagers can be and how selectively brilliant they can be whilst also having these blind spots.
In the book, though, they're sort of forced into a situation where they are more responsible and kind of wise than the adults around them. And I'm curious if you see the book as a kind of indictment of this generation of parents. And I guess I have to include myself in that.
Yeah, and I include myself. Yeah, so, you know, there's a generational schism over climate and extinction that's getting more and more visible to the mainstream. And that's partly because of the gestures of activists like Greta Thunberg, who's just a year older than my own daughter, and young people whose time horizon stretches decades beyond the personal lifetime horizons of those of us who are already out of our, you know, 20s and 30s, are the ones who will be so profoundly affected by our generation's inaction on making sure they have a livable future. And, you know, this generation is starting to notice and get angry, and I think the rage is long overdue, and I think it's the only rational response to the threats we face. So this novel is about that kind of righteous anger of the young, anger over the looming emergencies of extinction and runaway climate change, because I didn't feel it had been written too much about in literary fiction yet. Anger is what we need. We don't need anxiety management. We don't need therapy. because the future is going to be a fight. And you can't fight without anger.
So you've brought up climate change. This is obviously a book very much about climate change. And in our review, the critic refers to your OG status among writers on climate change. How do you feel about being associated with the term environmental writer? Is that the way you think of yourself? Because you've studied environmental science and have worked in conservation.
Now, I never have thought of myself primarily as environmental in my interests in fiction. It's just that now the environment and, you know, the natural world, they're very clearly our life support. And so I've actually always disliked the word environment and environmental. I don't think it sounds so dry and stodgy and wonky, you know, but really what we're talking about is the whole of the world that we co-evolved with and our physical life support. And so, yeah, I do write, I think increasingly over, I'll say the past decade or so, I've written more directly about these matters because I think they're existential and I can't write around them anymore. For a time, I didn't want to directly address these matters of existence because it's difficult to write about them in a way that's not polemic, in a way that's frankly bearable to read. And so for a long time, I sort of held myself apart and only addressed these climate and extinction crises sort of laterally in the writing. But it was sort of an elephant in the room for me. I couldn't not write about it at a certain point anymore. So yeah, I have become preoccupied with the failure of our culture to change our way of life, to protect our future and the future of the other critters that, you know, that we depend on.
Well, while that is a very serious subject, it certainly isn't dry in this book. There's a lot of humor in it. There's your distinctive style and sensibility, which runs throughout your work. And yet, I have to say this, it does seem like each book that you write is a little bit of departure from the previous book, even though that your style runs throughout. I wonder, do you feel like you're constantly challenging yourself and experimenting and sort of forcing yourself to do something new? Because Sweet Lamb of Heaven, for example, was a kind of thriller. This is very much not that.
You put it very kindly. I think I just don't like to write the same book twice, because I have a short attention span. So I'm unable to sort of replicate previous books. I'm glad that my style seems consistent in some way. I specifically with this book, because in the past I've tended to write books that are more satirical or lampoon-like on the one hand and more oriented toward humor. And then on the other hand, books that are less so like Sweet Lamb of Heaven that really are more about ideas and abstraction and are perhaps more earnest. And so with this book, I wanted to try to write a book that was based on ideas and took as its subject things about which I'm passionate, but also not have it be humorless. So I really, my project here was to try to make a serious book that also contained humor. And of course, we get humor generally by objectifying. And so the parents became my victims in that way.
So in the book, of course, there is this flood, this disaster, this impending end times. And here we are. Your book is coming out in the middle of a pandemic. Obviously, that's not something you could have predicted, I'm assuming, unless you somehow did. How does it feel to have this particular story out in the world at this moment?
Well, you know, it is a kind of direct parallel because, you know, in the book, there are these epic storms and floods and in the pandemic, there's disease. But in real life, both of them are being caused by a massive structural failure to address looming threats, right? So the scale of the disruption that we're living in is a product of bad national management, you know, selfish and stupid political leadership at the federal level. It's not a natural disaster. It spiraled out of control here because of irrational behavior at high levels of government. And so exactly like runaway climate change, it's the product of a void of political will, of reality denialism by the powers that are running the country. You know, it didn't have to be this way. This isn't Ebola. It doesn't have a 50% case fatality rate. Its scope and economic effects are the direct result of basically a failure of national security. And I think there's a very clear, not even a link, it's part of the same problems of our exploitation and abuse of the natural world, wildlife and of animals in general. It's bad behavior on our part and bad policy we make or don't make to prevent that bad behavior.
Are these the issues, I'm assuming, that you're continuing to explore through the nonfiction book that you're writing right now?
I do. I do explore them. You know, medieval bestiaries were these compendia of animals and also sometimes minerals and occasionally plants, but stories would be told about them to illustrate good Christian comportment. They were morality tales. And so my book is about all these critters, all these beings that exist in the natural world, but also about us sort of, and about myself as an example of us sort of. And so the book sort of wants to be a new kind of bestiary. You know, it's not Christian as such, but it does link morality and ethics and even things like love to specific animals and how we see them and the roles that they play in our lives.
We should say at this point, on a slightly lighter note, that your pug has been participating on the sidelines of this interview, which is, I guess, one of the benefits of recording a podcast during a quarantine.
You can call it a benefit. That's charitable. He appreciates it. He's actually lying on the bed now holding a really disgusting, decrepit, small stuffed cat in his mouth that is sort of his security blanket and smells really bad.
Well, let's hope for all of our sakes that he's not there the next time you join us for the podcast, Lydia.
I hope to be with you again in person one day.
Thanks so much.
Those were our conversations with Celeste Ng from 2017 and Judy Blume from 2015. We'll have more from the Book Review Podcast Archive next week. Thank you for listening.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than a life policy. It's about the promise and the responsibility that comes with being a new parent. Being there day and night. And building a plan for tomorrow, today. For the ones you'll always look out for, trust Amica Life Insurance. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.